place she now goes to with her friends. I warned her that her first or second outings there would still be haunted by memories of Rich, but by the third or fourth visit, the new associations would start to become strong enough to compete with the old ones. When trying to replace old and painful associations with new ones, we have to be careful about one thing. We must avoid reinforcing the old associations. Consequently, I advised Kathy to avoid mentioning Rich when at the brunch place, and as much as possible, to avoid even thinking about him. Holding on to reminders can keep us holding on to pain. Rigidly avoiding reminders of our loss can lead us to forego important aspects of our lives, but holding on to them too tightly can be just as problematic. Roughly 4 months after Ben's dog Bova died, he called me prior to our session to let me know he had been delayed by a last-minute conference call with his boss, and he would not be able to get to my office in time. He asked if we could do the session via a video call. I agreed. Ben's computer was situated in the corner of his living room. Consequently, I had a clear view of his living room and the adjacent open kitchen. Ben began catching me up on his latest clash with his boss, but I barely heard a word. I was totally distracted by what I saw behind him. There, at the foot of Ben's small dining table, were Bova's food and water bowls. I waited for an opening and asked Ben about it. He sheepishly tilted his laptop down to show me that Bova's large flat cushion was still at the foot of his workstation. He also admitted that Bova's brush and comb remained in the kitchen drawer with his other grooming tools, and that his leash still hung on the coat rack by the front door. Ben was no stranger to grief. He had experienced significant loss twice before when his parents died. I had worked with him at that time and knew he was well aware that holding on to too many vivid reminders could make those losses feel perpetually fresh and painful. By living with Bova's things all around him, Ben was preventing the psychological scabs time creates from forming over his emotional wound. That said, I did understand why he was doing it. When we lose someone, we often hold on to their clothes and the objects we associate with them, because removing them feels disloyal. Similarly, when a beloved pet dies, putting away their toys and grooming instruments, disposing of remaining food, and removing their crates, cages, or pillows can feel like an impossible task. The mere thought of doing so can evoke powerful feelings of guilt. We feel like we are betraying an animal that has been unconditionally loyal to us throughout their lives. It can even feel as though we are disrespecting their memory. Ben felt all those things. He rationalized holding on to those reminders by telling himself he would put Bova's things away when he felt ready to do so. A part of him knew that having Bova's things around him was actually preventing him from feeling ready, but with each passing day the thought of disposing of Bova's possessions felt more and more impossible. A similar drama often plays out when a heart is broken by romantic love. Some of us cling to every reminder we have, surrounding ourselves with the evidence of what we once had but lost. And some of us prefer to dispose of all reminders as quickly as possible, to erase every trace of the person who broke our heart and of our time with them. Although these are entirely opposite approaches, one is not necessarily better or healthier than the other, at least not initially. Whether we choose to eliminate reminders or hoard them in the immediate aftermath of a breakup or loss reflects our first reactions, our emotional reflex. The question is, what we do past that moment. Reminders are psychological representations of our emotional attachment to the pet we lost, or the person who broke our heart. As we process our loss and move through our grief, this attachment should weaken with time. Disposing of reminders reflects our willingness to let go and our readiness to move on. If months later we are still keeping too many of them, it can be a sign we have become stuck. Getting rid of those reminders will certainly feel torturous in the moment, but this is one of those times we need to pay a short-term price for a long-term gain. The vast majority of people I've worked with report feeling a significant reduction in emotional pain and a big improvement in mood in the days following a reminder purge. How many reminders we choose to keep, if any, depends on whether we can do so while still letting go and moving forward. Those who prefer to eliminate all reminders early on face a different complication. While it is easy enough to locate physical reminders in our home, car, or office, virtual reminders typically exist in multiple locations. Between our social media accounts, digital photos, blogs, texts, emails, dating sites, and other warehouses of digital information, finding and purging them can be a tricky task indeed. I recently worked with Svetlana, a nurse in her 30s. Svetlana met a man in a popular dating app, and they went out for several months. Things began to go badly, and the relationship deteriorated rapidly, leading to her boyfriend making an abrupt exit. Heartbroken, Svetlana quickly fell into the familiar trap of idealizing her ex and convincing herself he was the one. We spent weeks working on her recognizing his faults and the flaws in the relationship, both of which were numerous, and slowly she regained a more balanced perspective. A couple of months after the breakup, Svetlana felt ready to date again. Since she did not want to run across her ex's profile, she cancelled her membership to the site she had met him on and joined two newer dating sites instead. The first immediately sent her a list of 5 potential matches. She swiped left when she saw the first 2, i.e. she was not interested. The third profile was that of her ex. She cancelled her membership. A week later, the second app sent her their weekly list of great matches. And there again was her ex's smiling face. "I knew he was the perfect man for me," Svetlana sobbed when she told me about it. "And every matchmaking algorithm out there agrees. I know he wasn't perfect, but the universe is telling me he was the one." "May I see one of your profiles?" I asked. "Why?" Svetlana asked. "Because I'm wondering how you described the person you were looking for." Svetlana brought up her profile and handed me her phone. Sure enough, every descriptor she had listed matched her ex perfectly, including height, weight, hair and eye color, profession, and hobbies. I handed her back the phone and said, "The universe is only telling you what you told it. It's not the algorithms, it's you." Svetlana nodded. She had not even realized she was doing it. Indeed, I have worked with numerous people who joined dating sites after getting divorced, only to see their ex-wives and ex-husbands show up as suggested matches. Such incidents reflect the consistency of our tastes, much more than they do divine intervention. These days, digital reminders of our broken hearts can easily haunt our filing and storage systems. We innocently click on a file and discover a photo album we had forgotten existed. These kinds of unexpected virtual encounters can be both painful and shocking. Some of us might react by quickly clicking delete, but others might be tempted into a painful trip down memory lane that only reactivates hurt feelings and heartache we might have already put behind us. Social media platforms are even more problematic in this regard. The person who broke our heart often remains connected to people we know, making it possible for their updates and posts to be shared by third parties and show up in our feeds. Another major complication of heartbreak in the digital age is the reaction to the breakup among our friends and followers on social media. A recent study examined how breakups play out on Twitter. One of the phenomena the researchers observed was batch unfollowing. People often lost 15 to 20 followers in the immediate aftermath of a breakup as friends took sides and dropped one member of the couple in favor of the other. A similar phenomenon occurs on Facebook, where a breakup can be followed by a large drop in the number of a person's friends. Social media users are often extremely cognizant of their follower numbers as these statistics represent not just the size of our social circles, but our sphere of influence and our relative importance in the social media world. Such batch losses can easily add hurt and embarrassment to an already painful breakup. If losing followers and friends is important to us, we should take the time to replenish by reaching out to new people and inviting them to follow, friend, or connect with us. Seeing our numbers go back to where they were can at least slightly ease our distress. As for losing friends to the breakup, the reality of breakups is such that friends will indeed choose sides, either because our ex expresses an expectation to that effect, or because they think the other person would want them to do so. Therefore, in some cases, it might be possible to reach out to some of the people who unfriended us and let them know we would like to stay connected. Although we risk getting turned down by doing so, we might be pleasantly surprised by their response, especially if the breakup was not acrimonious. Avoiding the typical mistakes we make when our heart is broken will help us from slipping backwards or getting stuck on our journey to recovery. Breaking these kinds of damaging habits is hugely important, as is the need to adopt healing ones. However, in order to take the final steps toward fixing our broken heart, we must be willing to make one crucial decision: to let go. Chapter 4. Healing starts in the mind. Broken hearts are engines of endless psychological paradox. We want nothing more than to end our emotional pain, yet we indulge thoughts and behaviors that only deepen it. We feel dismissed, rejected, and abandoned, yet idealize the person who caused those feelings. We are desperate to move past our grief, yet we tenaciously hold on to reminders and keepsakes that keep us submerged in it. Why does heartbreak ensnare us in so many paradoxes? To answer this question, we must first revisit our evolutionary past. Generally speaking, our body's priority is always to heal and keep us alive. When we get physically injured, we do not have to make a conscious decision to heal, as our body does so spontaneously. But our mind's priority is not to repair bone and tissue, but to keep us away from situations that have hurt us in the past. The more painful an experience is, the harder our mind will work to make sure we do not make that mistake again. To that end, when our heart is broken, our mind tries to keep our pain fresh and unforgettable by having thoughts and images of our loss pop into our heads when we least expect them. It makes sure to flood us with anxiety and stress when we consider dating again, and to infuse us with guilt if we are tempted to get another pet after losing one we had cherished. But while our mind wants us to make sure we do not forget, to recover from heartbreak, we need to be able to do just that. We need to decrease the time we spend dwelling on our loss and reduce the importance it has in our thoughts and our lives. This simple conflict of interest between our unconscious mind and our conscious goals is hugely important. If we wish to heal more quickly and completely, we need to take deliberate action to override the damaging dictates of our unconscious mind and adopt new habits to bolster our emotional health. Doing so is very different from the current belief so many of us have about heartbreak that asserts we need only let time do its work. Time will do its work, but it will do it slowly and often ineffectively, and it can leave us with wounds that never fully healed. Our bodies heal well automatically. Our minds do not. However, this mental disadvantage also has a bright side. While we cannot command white blood cells to attack a virus or instruct our bones to heal, we can affect what happens in our mind if we are sufficiently determined to do so. There is a vast difference between wanting our emotional pain to stop and making a firm decision to make it stop. Wishing we could move on is not the same as resolving to do so. To fully heal when our heart is broken, we have to look in the mirror, metaphorically and perhaps literally, and tell ourselves, It's time to let go. And that can be extremely difficult. The many different ways we need to let go. What makes letting go so challenging is that we need to let go of far more than mere emotional pain. We need to let go of hope, of the fantasy in which we undo what went wrong, of the psychological presence the person or pet has in our daily thoughts and thus in our lives. We need to truly say goodbye, to turn away from love, even when there is no longer a person or animal there to receive it. And we need to let go of a part of ourselves, of the person we were when our love still mattered. Kathy was addicted to her memories of Rich. Her mind justified her indulging them by creating a false narrative that something had happened during their romantic weekend together that caused the breakup. To move on, Kathy had to make the same decision every addict must if they wish to turn their lives around and escape the clutches of the substance that controls them. She would have to give up her quest for answers, her drug, and go cold turkey. In order to do so, Kathy needed to be ready to manage the powerful cravings and intense withdrawal that would try to break her resolve. She would have to conquer the powerful urges that would compel her to revisit her memories and get one more taste of the happiness she had felt that weekend. She would have to anticipate the many excuses and justifications her mind would concoct to entice her back into her old habits and be ready to argue against them. Letting go was an equally torturous decision for Ben. Ben's dog Bova had been exquisitely attuned to his moods. His ability to recognize when Ben needed comfort and affection was remarkable. To Ben, holding on to Bova's possessions was a way of returning the loyalty Bova had shown him for so many years. To move on, Ben would have to give up the reminders that cluttered his apartment and kept Bova's memory fresh. He would have to tolerate intense feelings of disloyalty and harness every ounce of emotional determination he had to withstand the emotional tidal wave of guilt that was sure to come. He would have to realize those were distortions his mind created to keep him from moving on, that his debt to Bova had already been paid. Ben bristled when I suggested as much. Bova was far more loyal to me than I was to him. He was devoted to me. He was devoted, I agreed. But your devotion to him was even greater. You were his owner. Bova had no one else to focus his loyalty on. You did, at least theoretically. Yet you chose to be devoted only to him. Ben looked at me confused. Huh? Who else could I have been loyal to? A woman. Oh, Ben responded. Ben, you barely dated since your divorce. Wasn't Bova the reason? Wasn't there a part of you that felt he was enough? Wasn't there a part of you that refrained from getting emotionally attached to another person out of loyalty to Bova? Ben sat back and thought for a moment. Dating sucks. It can, I said. And Bova was so loving and affectionate and consistent, Ben sighed. He was enough. Yes, he was. His memory is not. Ben, you repaid your debt of loyalty to Bova while he was alive, many times over. Now you have to be loyal to yourself, to your own needs and happiness. Ben recognized what he had to do, but that didn't make it any less painful. The next day he took all of Bova's possessions and placed them in a box, weeping as he did it. He was finally on the path of healing, but I knew he had more work to do. The power of self-compassion. Lauren, who felt crushed after her first date in years rejected her, was caught in a paradox that ensnares many who suffer romantic disappointment. She believed her only chance for happiness depended on finding a partner, yet she was too terrified and pessimistic to try dating again. In an effort to protect herself from further heartache, Lauren's mind convinced her she was too unattractive to ever find love, so there was no point trying. To heal and move on, Lauren had to be willing to let go of her self-critical convictions and adopt a new mental habit, one that would limit her self-loathing and build her confidence, self-compassion. Self-compassion involves developing a non-judgmental inner voice that responds to our own suffering with kindness and caring rather than self-blame. Practicing it involves replacing self-critical thoughts with supportive and compassionate ones. It requires us to respond to our mistakes with patience and understanding, recognizing that erring is a part of being human. We can certainly acknowledge our mistakes and shortcomings, but we should not chastise and punish ourselves for them. Doing so yields no insights, and it has a terrible impact on our self-esteem, confidence, and overall emotional health. When I suggested Lauren adopt the practice of self-compassion, she was naturally hesitant. Behavioral habit change is hard enough. Changing our mental habits is harder. Switching her thinking to a diametrically opposed track would require Lauren to make a firm decision and then back it up with a serious dollop of motivation and willpower. I had faith in Lauren's willpower. The sticking point for her was the initial decision to change. Since she was a medical student, I decided to share with her some recent research findings. I told her about studies that investigated the impact of self-compassion on our mental health. The findings were significant and had been replicated many times. Practicing self-compassion increases self-esteem, improves psychological and social functioning, lowers depression and anxiety, enhances emotional health, and bestows an array of other psychological benefits. Lauren was intrigued. She accepted that self-compassion worked for some people. She just didn't know if it was something she would be able to do. Seeing as she had opened the door, I suggested some specific techniques. Scientists have found that one way to increase our self-compassion is to be compassionate toward others. For example, in one study, the mere act of writing a comforting message to a heartbroken stranger increased the self-compassion with which participants regarded a negative incident from their own past. Another technique to limit self-critical thoughts is to imagine ourselves saying those thoughts aloud to a dear friend who was hurting. Most of us would recoil at the notion of being so cruel to a friend in need, a stark reminder that we should recoil just as much when we direct the same critical words toward ourselves. "Okay, I'll try it," Lauren finally agreed. Since she was a self-confessed nerd, I decided to quote Yoda. "There is no try." Well-versed in Star Wars, Lauren nodded and said, "Do or do not." I cautioned Lauren that practicing self-compassion requires both patience and mindfulness. It is easy to slip into our old ways of thinking and resurrect our self-critical inner voice, and we need to be on guard and catch ourselves when we do so. All habit change is effortful at first, but usually after about a month of daily practice, the habit becomes more ingrained. For Lauren, it took 5 weeks of daily mindfulness and attention. She posted stickers all around her apartment, reminding her to be compassionate toward herself. She put self-compassionate motifs on her home screen, on her phone and laptop. She even made up a silly ditty to hum to herself. The only line she disclosed was, "I ain't wearing no self-swearing, self-compassion's my new fashion." Her abilities as a songwriter aside, Lauren's approach is a good example of the lengths to which we need to go if we truly want to change our way of thinking. Without the many visual reminders, fine and the song, it would have been hard for her to remain consistent and get the new habit ingrained enough to become self-sustaining. Happily, Lauren's efforts paid off. The change I saw in her over time was remarkable, especially in her self-esteem. When our heart is broken and our self-esteem has taken a severe blow, what we need most is to revive it. We should heal ourselves by focusing on our best qualities, everything we have to offer that a potential relationship partner would appreciate. And yet too often we do the opposite, focus on every shortcoming we have, and on all the reasons we believe we are likely to be rejected again in the future. Lauren had been an expert at shooting her self-esteem in the foot, if not the heart. I therefore insisted she start every session by listing 5 good qualities she had to offer in the dating world without repeating ones she had already used. While she could barely get any out at first, with each passing week she got more comfortable. Once she was able to deliver her list confidently and without any qualifiers, I knew she was ready to start dating again. Lauren did too. She reactivated her profile on a dating site soon thereafter. Recognizing new voids and filling them. Ben had finally removed Bova's pillow, bowls, and leash from view, but his emotional recovery was by no means complete. He used to take Bova to a dog run every morning before he began work. Bova had regular playmates there, and Ben had become friendly with their owners. He sat and chatted with them for 30 minutes to an hour while their dogs played, much as parents and nannies do when taking their children to a playground. Ben had a limited circle of friends, and his dog-run clutch had formed a meaningful chunk of his social life. Now that Bova was gone, he often went days without having a face-to-face conversation with another person. We usually perceive the loss of a beloved pet as creating a void in our lives. What we often do not realize is that it creates far more than one. Once Ben recognized how many voids Bova's death had left, he agreed he had to find ways to fill them. But he couldn't think of a single hobby, activity, or pastime that held any appeal. There was simply nothing in which he wanted to invest time and effort. He felt entirely stumped. "Okay, so there are no passions or interests that grab you," I said to him in our next session. "I can think of only one option then. You need another warm body back in your life." "I'm not ready to get another dog," Ben interrupted. "Again, I meant a woman." Again, Ben said, "Oh." Ben finally relented and agreed to post a profile on a dating app. He specified one important condition in his profile. The woman he was looking for had to love dogs. Over the next couple of months, Ben went on a few dates, none of which yielded a second. But spending time messaging various women and occasionally meeting them for dates went a long way toward filling some of the voids in his life. His mood improved, as did his work, and for the first time since Bova died, his boss actually complimented him on an assignment. We stopped working together shortly after. I don't know whether Ben found a new relationship or whether he ever got another dog. I would like to think he did both. I do believe that if his heart gets broken again in the future, he will reach out to me. And much as I am curious to know how he's doing, for that reason alone, I hope I never hear from him again. Using mindfulness to battle rumination. Studies of how heartbroken people heal have revealed the importance of attaining closure in achieving timely and healthy adjustment. Specifically, in order to move on, we have to reach a solid understanding of why the breakup occurred. As we've seen, being clear about the why helps us let go of our hopes and fantasies of reconciliation and attain closure. But what do we do when our questions cannot be answered? Breakups are often cruel. We come home to empty apartments, receive a terse text message, or find out our ex has changed their relationship status to single on a social media platform. Even when we are given the courtesy of an explanation, it is often insufficient. For example, "I have finals coming up, so it's not a good time for me to be in a relationship." Vague. For example, "It's not you, it's me." Uninformative. For example, "I'm just not in the right place." Or unjustly accusatory. For example, "I just can't deal with how emotional you get when I yell at you." Many of us try to extract a clearer or more honest response from the person who broke our heart, but such efforts rarely succeed. Perhaps it is best they do not. Whatever explanation the other person offers will not change the bottom line. They felt we were incompatible in some way. Further, pursuing a more complete answer is likely to make us emotionally vulnerable and open the door to feeling hurt, enraged, frustrated, or bewildered all over again. Instead, we should come up with our own explanation for why the breakup occurred. A best guess that fits the facts, considers the personality and past behavior of our ex, takes the context of the breakup and recent history into account, and, most important, leaves our pride, dignity, and self-esteem intact. If we have to fill in the blanks ourselves, we might as well do so in a way that makes us feel better about things, not worse. a rationale we can sell both to ourselves and to others. A good example of a worthy breakup rationale is the one Rich gave Kathy. He cared for Kathy and enjoyed her company tremendously, but he had just not fallen in love. His reasons were measured, non-judgmental, and compassionate, a rare thing in the world of heartbreak, which was why it was so unfortunate Kathy chose to reject his explanation and launch a 6-month quest for an alternative one. By that point, Kathy could no longer deny how stuck she was. She was finally willing to consider the futility of her search and accept what Rich had told her. Doing so was by no means an easy decision. She was still consumed by an obsessive urge to ruminate about Rich, compelled by the reward circuitry in her brain that created withdrawal symptoms that were hard to withstand. Once we spend weeks and months stewing about our ex, quitting the habit cold turkey can be extremely challenging. Fortunately, there are psychological techniques that are effective in countering this kind of obsessive rumination. Rumination involves a repetitious focus on negative thoughts and memories of all kinds, not just related to heartbreak, that can easily become habitual and lead to elevated risk of clinical depression. The key to breaking free of rumination is to counteract its negative pull by fostering ways of thinking that are strictly non-judgmental. The most potent and successful of these techniques is called mindfulness meditation. Mindfulness meditation involves focusing on our internal states and experiences in the present. One can do so in a variety of ways. We can focus on the sensation of air entering our lungs, the smells around us as we breathe, how the wind or the sun feel against our face, the patterns cracks make in the sidewalks and streets we walk on, or the different hues of green in the plants and trees we pass on our walk. Whenever our attention is drawn to an unrelated thought, for example, "I can't believe my ex dumped me," we simply note the thought non-judgmentally. For example, "I had a thought about my ex," and bring our awareness back to our present experience. Mindfulness meditation is a form of cognitive training, like a workout for your mind, much like self-compassion is. As such, it requires daily practice. Beginners might experience intrusive thoughts regularly and spend most of their time bringing their focus back to their breathing. But the more we practice, the longer we will be able to stay within our meditative focus, and the disruptions of negative and other thoughts will decline. Mindfulness is not just a form of meditation. It is a way of thinking and being in which we choose to focus on our experience of the present, the scents of the different flowers as we stroll through a park, the song of the birds outside our window as we rest in a chair, or the noises of a busy street as we walk to work. Mindfulness has been extensively studied in recent years. Directing attention to our present experience, rather than ruminating about the past or worrying about the future, has been demonstrated to have significant psychological benefits, such as reducing stress, distractibility, rumination, and obsessional thinking. I instructed Kathy on the basics of mindfulness training and suggested she practice at least 5 times a week. Given how severe her ruminating had become, I expected her progress to be slow. But only 5 weeks later, she came into the session and announced good news. Kathy's ultimate goal was to go an entire week without thinking about Rich. It was a big ask. Was it possible she had already achieved it? "I didn't think of Rich for 6 hours," she said. I was certainly encouraged by the fact that Kathy went 6 hours without thinking about Rich, but what encouraged me even more was her enthusiasm. Apparently, her initial skepticism about the technique had diminished, and she was ready to get serious. And she did. Kathy's powerful determination, that which had been channeled into getting her through cancer treatments, only to be diverted into fueling her ruminative quest to solve the non-existent riddle of her breakup, came back. Once again, Kathy harnessed her motivation and perseverance to improve her health, this time her mental health. She signed up for mindfulness meditation classes, she read books about it, joined a meetup group, recruited 2 of her friends to practice with her, and downloaded endless lectures and podcasts on the subject. Mindfulness meditation does not just reduce rumination and self-criticism, it can also lower our emotional reactivity to distressing thoughts or events, such that even when the same old harmful thoughts do come up, they pack less punch. Indeed, Kathy not only had fewer intrusive thoughts about Rich, she also found the ones she did have to be less upsetting and easier to banish. I next saw Kathy after several weeks, and the change in her was noticeable. Finally, she no longer looked like she was in continual pain. "I'm loving the mindfulness meditation," Kathy said, "but it's possible I went a little overboard. My friends thought I was just substituting one addiction with another." "Did you agree?" I asked. "A bit," she admitted. "So I decided to continue the daily meditations, but drop the evening classes. I was thinking of dropping them anyway. I needed to free up some time." "For?" I asked. Kathy took out her phone and showed me a text she had sent to her friends the night before. "I'm ready!" "It's Raining Men" began playing in my head. I sat back and said, "Hallelujah." Recovering who we are. All relationships require us to modify how we see ourselves. We change our pronoun use and substitute I and my with we and our. We gravitate towards socializing with other couples and see single friends less often. We give up individual interests and adopt mutual ones. We modify the products we use. We change our habits both in the home and outside it, and the list goes on. When our relationship ends, we then have to readjust and reconnect to who we are as individuals. Numerous studies have found that recovering our sense of self and getting in touch with our core is a crucial variable in our ability to heal from heartbreak. One recent study examined changes in participants' self-concept and emotional well-being over an 8-week period following a breakup. Researchers measured participants' self-concept and psychological well-being using both questionnaires and facial electromyography, FEMG. A FEMG measures tiny changes in facial muscles that are indicative of an emotional response but are not discernible to the naked eye. Together, the two methods confirmed that when people whose hearts were broken failed to redefine their sense of self, their adjustment to the breakup was poorer, and they experienced greater psychological distress. The same was true of participants who exhibited strong emotional reactions to thoughts of their partner. The researchers concluded that one of the reasons we struggle to redefine our sense of self after a breakup is because we are unconsciously continuing to define ourselves by our now-defunct relationship. Reconnecting to who we are is an equally vital task when we lose a cherished pet. When Lindsay's cat, Mittens, died, she lost a vital aspect of her identity. Lindsay had always defined herself as a mother, a wife, and an athlete. Her role as a mother was clearly the most important to her, and although she would never admit it, her role as an athlete had always been a close second. Lindsay continued to work out, but while she maintained her running and swimming schedules, she barely biked at all. However, biking had been her strongest leg in the triathlon, the one to which she felt most connected. Her next big race was supposed to take place less than a month after Mittens died. A few days before the race, Lindsay told me she had decided to drop out. "I used to be an athlete," she said, "but since Mittens died..." "Wait, wait, wait," I interrupted. "You used to be an athlete? Is it acceptable to you that you no longer are?" "No, but it's a reality." "The only reality is that Mittens died," I responded. "That reality you can't change. But whether you are an athlete, whether you give up the sport you love, is not a reality. It's a choice." Lindsay was making a mistake many of us make when faced with the task of redefining ourselves in the face of grief. She was looking to her actions to define who she was, rather than deciding who she wanted to be and figuring out which actions supported that self-definition. I urged Lindsay to figure out how she might continue her training, as triathlons played a key role in her life, one she could not afford to lose. She agreed to consider the idea. so I decided to push her a little further. I told her there was a relevant research finding, a single variable that has repeatedly predicted healthier and quicker emotional adjustments to heartbreak. But it is one that most people balk at, finding a replacement for the pet or person they have lost. To be clear, going out on dates when a heart has been broken and getting a new pet after we lose a beloved one can feel inappropriate, premature, awkward, disloyal, unwise, unfair, and just plain wrong. And yet doing so has been shown to effectively ease both emotional pain and grief, because it reduces our attachment to the person or pet we lost. Of course, time is a factor as well. Should Kathy have rushed out and started dating the day after Rich broke up with her? No. Should Ben have left the vets after Bova died and gone right to the local animal shelter to get another dog? No. But we do not have to wait until we are totally over it to take such steps either. We might not be entirely emotionally available when we first start dating after a difficult breakup. But if we met someone we were interested in getting to know further, we can always let him or her know we need to take things slowly. Similarly, getting another pet does not mean we should abandon our thoughts and memories of the one that died. Our hearts are big enough to mourn one animal while still being able to care for another. It might take us longer to fall in love with our new pet when we're still grieving the old one, but only a little. Pets are usually quite adept at finding their way into an animal lover's heart. Lindsay was spared the decision of whether she was ready to get another cat. Apparently, I was not the only one who felt she needed to get back to her training and embrace her role as a triathlete. A few weeks later, her husband and kids surprised her on her birthday with a big box with holes on top. Inside was a new kitten. The next morning, Lindsay took the kitten down to the basement, placed it on the shelf, and got on her bike. Recovering from heartbreak always starts with a decision, a determination to move on when our mind is fighting to keep us stuck. The battle ahead requires courage and determination, but also knowledge and awareness. We have to understand the ways our mind is working against us and take steps to counter the unhealthy urges and habits that are setting us back. We have to fight the addictive tendency to keep those whom we have lost in our lives, whether via memories or reminders. We have to rebuild our self-esteem by practicing self-compassion. We have to adopt mindfulness to battle obsessive thoughts of our loss. We have to recognize the voids that have been created in our lives and take steps to fill them. We have to reconnect to our core so we can get back in touch with the essence of what makes us who we are. Our heart might be broken, but we do not have to break with it. We can fight back and move on when sufficient time has passed, even if we do not feel ready to do so. We can take control of our lives and our minds and put ourselves on the path to healing. Emotional pain should not and need not be a constant companion. Do not let it become one. Epilogue. Making Emotional Pain Visible. I have worked with scores of heartbroken people over the past 20 years, and I remember many of them vividly. This is not surprising, as the ease with which we recall events is heavily influenced by their intensity and the raw emotion and terrible anguish of a person whose heart just got broken is hard to forget. This is especially true when the patient sitting across from me is a teenager. The hormone-fueled intensity of adolescence, the already heightened emotions that go with it, and their inexperience and innocence render teenagers exquisitely vulnerable to the agony of heartbreak. One teenage patient in particular stands out in my mind, because his story encapsulated almost everything that is wrong with how we currently regard heartbreak. Greg was a highly intelligent, gay 17-year-old junior who had recently come out at school, thankfully to relatively little fanfare. Whereas straight high school kids have a wide range of romantic options from which to choose, LGBTQ youth typically face a much sparser selection. Greg spent 2 years nursing a crush on Devon, a senior, and one of only two other out gay kids in his school. A month after coming out, Greg finally gathered the courage to walk up to Devon during lunch and suggest they hang out. As happens far too often with teenagers, Devon's rejection was both swift and unnecessarily cruel. Feeling both humiliated and absolutely gutted, Greg made his way to his history class, in which he was scheduled to have a big exam. Greg's best friend, who was straight, always sat next to Greg in history, and Greg hoped to have a few moments to talk with his buddy and get support before the exam began. But when Greg arrived in class, his friend was not there. As he later found out, his friend had twisted his ankle while shooting hoops during the lunch break. When the history teacher saw the swollen ankle, she excused him from the test and sent him to the nurse's office for treatment. Alone and with no support, Greg spent the hour fighting tears while struggling to focus on his exam. Knowing he had done poorly, indeed he had failed, Greg approached the history teacher after class to explain why he had trouble concentrating during the test. But instead of responding with empathy or compassion, Greg's teacher chastised him for making excuses. This is the message we're sending high school kids about emotional versus physical pain. If your ankle swells, even slightly, your physical discomfort will be noticed, and you will be afforded both compassion and consideration. But if your heart gets ripped out of your chest, and the emotional pain you feel is so severe you can't even concentrate, you'll be given neither. If this is how we educate our youth, is it any surprise that heartbreak is so poorly understood, that emotional pain is so often ignored? And if nothing in her schooling or training gave her any tools to deal with students whose heart just got broken, should we be surprised by Greg's teacher responding as she did? I am not advocating we excuse every teenager who claims to have a broken heart from taking exams. Given how frequently teenagers get their hearts broken, we would end up with more students sitting out exams than taking them. Yes, separating the normative, psychological, and emotional distress adolescents experience on a daily basis from an exceptional, urgent, or acute situation is by no means an easy call. But Greg was not someone nursing his hurt feelings from a rejection or breakup that happened days or weeks previously. He was an A student, blinking back tears in obvious emotional pain. We desperately need a more open dialogue about how severely heartbreak impacts our emotions and functioning. And for such discussions to be productive, we have to disavow ourselves of the notion that there is something childish, embarrassing, or inappropriate about feeling severe emotional anguish when our heart is broken, because heartbreak is devastating at any age. We suffer emotional pain that is nearly unbearable for days, weeks, and even months on end. Our body experiences stresses that can damage both our short-term and long-term health. Our grief activates circuitry in our brain that causes withdrawal symptoms similar to those experienced by people who are addicted to cocaine or heroin. Our ability to focus and concentrate, think creatively, problem-solve, and generally function at our regular capacity becomes significantly impaired. Our lives are thrown upside down, leaving us questioning who we are and how to define ourselves going forward. The fact that all this goes virtually unrecognized, if not entirely ignored, by society at large makes our ordeal far more challenging than it already is. Our individual friends and loved ones might offer us comfort and support, but only for a limited time. Our schools, institutions, workplaces, and even our healthcare system fail to do even that, the kind actions of some individual bosses or employers notwithstanding. What makes this state of affairs so unfortunate and truly unacceptable is that we are not fundamentally blind to grief. When a first-degree relative dies, especially if it is a spouse, parent, or child, siblings are last on the list, we are usually afforded time off, sympathy, compassion, and even a tacit understanding that we will not be functioning at our best as we grieve. Similarly, employers are likely to be at least supportive and sympathetic when we let them know we're going through a rough divorce. Our grief in such cases is both recognized and sanctioned, regardless of its magnitude. But other kinds of grief, such as the kinds of heartbreak we've explored here, is neither recognized nor sanctioned. It is disenfranchised, regardless of how emotionally devastated we are. Not only are we robbed of support and compassion, we are forced to expend our dwindling emotional reserves to hide how bereft we feel, lest we be judged for being overly emotional, immature, or weak of character. My concern about how we marginalize these kinds of grief is not just a reflection of my work with heartbroken patients. Studies of disenfranchised grief, and there are many of them, have found that when societies do not sanction grief, we internalize those standards and regard our own emotions and reactions as less legitimate. This lack of external and internal validation has also been found to negatively impact our psychosocial health and increase our risk for developing clinical depression. If emotional pain were visible, heartbreak and the suffering it caused would not remain disenfranchised for long. When we show up to work or school with a broken leg, arm, or even a broken finger, we often garner more attention, concern, and consideration because we can see the splints or bandages than we are likely to when our heart is broken. They are there as evidence that we hurt. And yet, broken bones inflict none of the profound cognitive, emotional, and psychological impairments heartbreak does. Most companies are hesitant to institutionalize sanctioned allowances for emotional health reasons, short of major mental diagnoses, because they fear employees will unfairly take advantage of them. However, their assumptions are both short-sighted and misguided. By not affording employees the time and support they need to heal, companies are left carrying the burden of less productive employees who are functioning below their capacity for extended durations of time. If companies recognized the debilitating impact of heartbreak and gave their employees time to grieve, get support, and recover, it would allow employees to return to full productivity sooner than they might otherwise. Rather than hide our emotional pain from our fellow students and colleagues, teachers and employers, we could heal it more quickly and minimize our periods of compromised productivity. If schools accepted the basic fact that emotional pain is just as important, legitimate, and debilitating as physical pain, they could train their educators to be more supportive of and compassionate toward students suffering from heartbreak. There is no reason why we do not teach our captive audience of middle and high school students how to avoid the mistakes that make our emotional pain worse, and how to adopt the habits that promote emotional health and healing. But we do not. If emotional pain were visible, we would all conduct ourselves very differently. We would find kinder ways to break up with the person we were dating, and we would be less cruel when rejecting people who expressed interest in us. We would show more concern when we saw someone sitting alone, an anguished look on their face. We would be more patient and less judgmental when a friend or loved one fails to get over a broken heart in what we consider a timely manner. And when our own heart gets broken, we would be more self-compassionate, feel less shameful about our distress, and more open to asking for the help we need. For now, though, we must remind ourselves that despite a lack of institutional support, we are not entirely defenseless against the psychological and physical assaults of heartbreak. There are things we can do and things we should avoid doing to ease our emotional pain, speed up our recovery, and heal the emotional and psychological wounds we suffered. Understanding what kinds of mistakes we must avoid and how to avoid getting stuck, and knowing what actions we should take and which habits to adopt in order to heal, means we are no longer at the mercy of the one curative ingredient over which we have no control, time. We can help our hearts heal, and we can be more proactive and supportive in helping other broken hearts heal as well. Heartbreak is all around us. It's time we opened our eyes and see it. For only then can we truly heal it and move on.
How to Fix a Broken Heart was written and read by Dr. Guy Winch. It was recorded and mixed by Terry Hogan at Simon & Schuster in New York. Editing and post-